Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Steve from Newport.
I'm Steve Scherzer, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be sober. Welcome if you're new. Thank you, Lisa, for extending the offer. Thank you, Brian, for setting me up on this. And thank you, Marcia, for reminding me. And to tell me to wear a necktie. So I asked Brian, because some groups are different, and you wore neckties. He says, "Nah, no one wears a necktie." And says every once in a while, some jerk from Bellflower shows up with a tie on, and my sponsor's Johnny Harris from Bellflower. So I'm glad you reminded me. I could go 40 minutes just on the whole necktie thing, but. I've kind of found that compliance is serves you kind of well around here, and I don't know if I'm doing this out of respect for AA, but certainly out of respect for your group. I'm happy to conform with your customs. I've learned a little bit about your group, the Aragon group, and I'm impressed. My home group is the 530 Fish Out of Water group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is kind of infamous, I guess, in some circles. Which I got sober in a 530 group in Santa Barbara, California in 1984. And I don't really think I'll ever be able to repay my debt to that group. And that's a big reason why I'm there. I'm a big believer in if you don't think your home group is the best group in all of Alcoholics Anonymous, you should find yourself a new home group. And that said, I'm also a big believer that after you've been here for a little bit, if you don't think your group's the best group in all of AA, you should be asking yourself, what can you do to make it better? And I'm also a big believer that there's a huge difference, maybe a critical difference for the survival of Alcoholics Anonymous, to think your group's the best group in all of AA and thinking your group's better than any other group. That there's some of that going on now. And I've been privileged to be sober in really three different areas: Santa Barbara, West LA, and Newport Beach now since '92. And it's very different in the three areas, and to be exposed to that. And Johnny's been my sponsor for maybe the last 12 or 13 years, so I am exposed to the Bellflower thing, which is done differently. And it's always amazing to me how spectacularly this thing works in a lot of different formats, and with a lot of different spiritual centers. Fish out of water don't suffer fools kindly in there. It gets a little rowdy, which is probably a factor of it being 5:30 in the afternoon, and a number of things, but I love that place, and I'm impressed with this. Welcome if you're new. I think I already said that, but this is certainly the best deal that's ever happened to me, with the possible exception of booze. I don't speak for AA, by the way, and as you'll probably soon find out, speaking isn't particularly my deal. I don't think there's been any part of my sobriety that's been less critical to obtaining and maintaining my sobriety than sharing at an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that goes for both from podiums and in participation meetings. I know it's given a lot of power. You know, you need to, and I hear a lot of that. You got to go in there and share, and that hasn't been my experience. And if you're part of one of your program is a participation meeting, and it's kind of racking you with, should I raise my hand or shouldn't I raise my hand? Don't worry about it. I promise you that eventually you're going to get so sick of hearing the same six people share every day, you're going to eventually raise your hand just to take up 5 minutes. I promise you. And that said, I'll also say that I don't think there's been any part of my sobriety that's been more important than sharing one-on-one with another alcoholic. Whether it be my sponsors and the people that came before me, some friendships that I maintain of people that got sober at about the time I did, and I've stayed extremely close with these last 24 plus years, and the people behind me. I want to wish happy birthday to Pat and Don. Pat is a good friend. You may recognize Pat from KCAL 9 News a couple years ago. Pat's a great example of Pat worked a hell of a program, and some things happened about a couple years ago. Pat had 10 years of sobriety, and he ended up loaded and couldn't stop, and he went to any lengths to get stopped, and I couldn't be happier that you're sober today. It's kind of a miracle. And Frank, his good friend, I kind of mentioned the friendship thing, because their relationship is really touching. And I think if there's any wish I could make for a new guy today, is to find a friend that is good as Frank and Pat are. They save each other's ass. They mock their sponsors behind their back and torture the new guys, but they're always on the same block. So I'm supposed to share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in Portland, Oregon. Welcome from Seattle. If you wonder what it's like living in Portland, just recall back the day before yesterday, Wednesday. You know, 44 degrees and rain for 24 hours for about 5 months. And so welcome from Seattle, where people have reason to drink. I don't know why they do down here, but I was raised in a suburb of Portland called Raleigh Hills, Oregon, home of the Raleigh Hills Hospitals, oldest treatment center west of the Mississippi, which my family helped support. My mom was an alcoholic, and I say that, I bring that up always, not because I think anything was transmitted through the family. She was kind of a secret drunk, a bottle hider. It progressed. My recollection is of my youth and my childhood is a very idyllic type childhood. I don't really recall much of it. She would go away. I can remember, you know, screaming over to Raleigh Hills Hospital, which kind of looked like the Addams Family monster house in the middle of the night. My rageaholic dad, you know, dropping her off at about 85 miles an hour, and the slipper people would come and grab her and bring her in. We'd get her back. It was an aversion therapy thing then. But there wasn't, it was never discussed. But from a very early age, I really got the idea of how bad a thing alcohol was, which is kind of a big part of my story. I remember visiting her as her disease progressed. She went through every kind of cure treatment deal. You know, it was a Valium deficiency for a while, and you know, everything. I remember visiting her at Holiday Park Psychiatric Hospital, where she was receiving electroshock therapy for her alcoholism. Even back then, they knew you had to change. And I'm sure she didn't feel like a drink the morning after electroshock therapy, but I remember seeing her at 8 or 9 years old and visiting her and knowing, thinking to myself, why would you drink? Why didn't you just stop? You know, the lights were on, but no one was home, and she just didn't get it. But it wasn't an attraction. You know, it wasn't one of these happy alcoholic families that are getting into fist fights and bottles are flying across rooms. I'm always so jealous of that. My family, I was fed this message kind of in my family. I don't know where it came from, that we were better than other people, which I could never figure out, because, God, I just thought my family sucked so bad. I got a... It had something to do with the fact we had vitamins or something. I have no idea what it was about, but was kind of raised in that era in the late 50s and early 60s, the Ozzie and Harriet and Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver, and just wondering why the hell, you know, matching my insides to their outsides. You know, little did I know at the time that no one saw Harriet Nelson off camera without a martini in her hand for about 50 years, and Ozzie was a raging control freak, but, you know, that's not what they showed you on the half hour. And just, I want to be anywhere else but my family. I think my drug of choice before I found alcohol was your approval. You know, I was real tuned in to what you were about, what your values were about. And I had a and that probably very rapidly evolved into just a desperate tear of any type of disapproval. So I did okay in school and did pretty well in athletics and this type of thing, but and kind of had to say everything was fine. You know, I really, to be honest with you, I'm not really too sure what it was like. I was kind of in an emotional blackout about the whole thing. My mom, I'll go ahead and get to the end of that one. I love these AA podium things where son and mother reunite in AA, you know, 40 years later, you know, after, and my mom died a wet brain the last 10 years of her life when I was about a year sober. It's really kind of the first time I have an older brother and twin younger brothers who are just right on the same, you know, they're the kind of that vibey thing that twins have. And but we have it's the first time we'd ever really talked about what happened in our family. We have four entirely different perceptions of what happened. They tell stuff about me that just makes my blood curdle. And I kind of have this, it was tousle-haired youth in Raleigh Hills, Oregon, you know. I don't know why I had those first three Blitz Weinhardt stubbies on a country road with Billy Wilson and Norman Dean Pettit when I was about 15 years old. Most of them had started drinking, and I just didn't. And it was just kind of a bad thing, bad thing, bad thing, bad thing, bad thing, and had them, and the magic of alcohol happened for me immediately. You know, a spiritual condition I didn't even know I had. This kind of inadequacy and insecurity and low-grade dread and it went away. The fear went away. And I was transported, rocketed to a fourth dimension. And I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. I comprehended the word serenity. Fear of people and economic insecurity left me. I intuitively knew how to handle situations which used to baffle me. It was kind of the kingdom. And I hear a lot of people share that, you know, they drank to stuff. I've kind of come to believe it's the same thing, but I have the absolute certainty that booze was the missing piece of my program. You know, I drank to become who I'm supposed to be. I drank to be somebody. It was the added thing that I needed, and transported me to a place that I'm grateful for. You know, I really believe booze and drugs get a really bad rap in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they took me to some places spiritually and emotionally I really needed to get to, and I don't believe I could have gotten there without them for taking the steps for 50 years. And I believe to this day that I'm an alcoholic not because of what alcohol and then drugs did to me over the course of the next 20 years, so much as I'm an alcoholic because of what those first three Blitz Weinhardt stubbies do for me and what Bose does for me. And I didn't know it didn't do that for the other 94% of the population. They affect a spiritual change that I desperately need to have. They relieve me. It relieves me from the bondage of self, albeit as time went on with a lot of short-circuiting. I didn't immediately become a daily drinker, but I immediately was obsessed with it. You know, we were still in high school, and you kind of stockpiled. Oregon has very strict liquor laws, and you know, it was difficult to get booze, but that's what we worked on all week long, was getting booze. I'd never broken a law to the best of my recollection before then, and I immediately started shoplifting booze. alcohol becomes a bigger problem for me, certainly at that stage when I'm not drinking than when I am. I'm still obsessed with your opinion of me. Still desperately need your approval. I'm still completely devoid of any type of value system of my own, but booze seems to relieve that. I was going to go into the service, this mid-60s, toward the later part of the 60s, out of high school. My dad wouldn't sign the papers. I was still a minor, and I went down to the University of Oregon in Eugene, and got over the whole going to Vietnam thing in about 5 minutes, and discovered drugs, which are a part of my story. You know, they transported me to some spiritual and emotional places I needed to go as well. And I became a daily drinker. I drank daily from then for the next 15 years until I ended up done. I kind of lived different lives. You kind of had to stay in school then because of the Vietnam deal, so I got through school in 4 years. I don't remember ever going to a class or reading a book. Some chemical things help with that. The house I lived in supplied dope to Ken Kesey's ranch, and the Grateful Dead were hooked up with Kesey and became kind of a really hardcore deadhead. And back in the days when we had good chemists, Osley and Sandoz, and then I kind of had this other life, you know, that, there's this fraternity chick, you know, that kind of whole deal. And she called me my senior year in college and crying, the sorority girl, Kathy Carmichael. Everybody loves Kathy Carmichael. Crying, and that her mother had invited my father to our engagement party. And I said, "We aren't getting married. We've never discussed this or anything." And I know. 3 hours later, you know, it's okay. We can have the party, but we're not getting married. And 6 months later, very, very drunk and very, very, very loaded. I'm 20 years old. I'm walking down the aisle in Modesto, California, going, "This is the worst mistake you'll ever make in your life." It turned out to be the worst mistake she ever made in her life. I didn't even like this girl. But you did. You know, you did. Everybody loved Kathy. You know, president of the Pebble Beach Junior League. You know, just a bitch. And I knew I wasn't prepared. I'm now, you know, I'm well in the deal. I'm not prepared to go get a job or anything. I'm a kid, for Christ's sake. And having no particular values or moral bearings of my own, I decided to go to law school. Sounded like a good idea. And that's the first time my drinking and using was going to change. And it did. I enrolled in law school at Santa Clara in the Bay Area, and went to every class and read every case and briefed the cases and read the Horn books, made outlines and did the whole deal, you know, didn't drink until I was through studying at night, and really made a major change in my life for about 3 weeks. And then it was like, if this is what it takes, this sucks. And I stayed loaded for the next 2.5 years, almost 3 years. Took the bar. Literally started doing the bar thing, a couple weeks before, and somehow got through that with the aid of chemistry. And, you know, I'm drinking at lunch, taking the bar exam. Was always going to go back. Didn't have any expectation of passing the thing. So kind of hung out in the Bay Area. Was always going to go back to Oregon, but somehow I passed and ended up going down to Monterey and started my law career. A guy had hired me, much to my surprise and chagrin. And within a couple months, I started my own firm with a guy I'd gone to law school with and then a guy I'd gone to undergrad with who I just ran into in Monterey. And things changed then too. I kind of buckled down. It became an afternoon bar, 5 o'clock bar drinker. And then it was a 4 o'clock bar drinker, and then a 3 o'clock bar drinker. I never drank. You know, I just crossed a lot of lines in those last 10 years. Never was going to drink at lunch, and then started drinking lunch on Fridays because there wasn't court Friday afternoons, and then was drinking lunch every day, and you know, it was bad. I represented some really heavy duty people up there, one in particular, and so drugs are part of my. I did cocaine one time for about 15 years, and you know, the last 5 years I'm drinking around the clock, and one of the as I still have this desperate thing that for you to think I'm doing okay, and we're kind of like the golden couple. She's the bitch president of the Pebble Beach Junior League. Last 2 years, I'm president of the Monterey County Bar Association. I've been sitting as a judge for 4 years on a pro tem basis. As you got closer and closer, it was like, you know, the French Impressionist painting. I'm a mess, but so she, my lovely bride, and I have two kids at this point. One of my partners and my doctor do an intervention on me in '83, and which seemed pretty hypocritical to me. This was a doctor who was writing me my Quaalude prescription that I had to split with him. So, but they had an intervention. He had his cousin or something was interventionist at a care unit there, and they worked on me. All I wanted, I don't know if you ever had an intervention, but all you want is just to get him away from you and get a drink. And I hadn't eaten in about 3 years, so I was having some stomach problems and figured what the hell, and went into this care unit in '83 and, you know, had the best month of my life. You know, I learned about the disease. I learned about myself. I learned it was possible to live without drinking and using. You're kind of, if you're in one of those treatment things, you know, after about a week, you're an old timer because people are coming in, so you're getting to help them and show them the road where the real coffee is, and you know, that whole deal. And you know, it was awesome. It was awesome. And we did the chip thing at the end. You know, you take your 30-day chip. It was for $18,000. They throw in the extra 2 days, and people were crying about how great I am, and I'm crying and all this. And I get in my car and I drink on the way home. It's eight blocks from that care unit on Hartnell Street to where I lived in Monterey, and within a week or two, I have to make a decision of, do I want this life that I have, this perfect life from a distance, or do I want to be a drunk? And it's the easiest decision I've ever made in my life, because I know what I am. And the other thing that, you know, it didn't really occur to me till it, the other reason why it was the easiest decision I've ever made in my life is because I'm already drinking at that point in time. If I'm drinking, I drink because I'm drinking. You know, the command center had long since lost control of the ship, you know, as the nature of my disease. And it doesn't care what I come up with up on the master bridge as to why we're going to drink vodka on the way to work at 6:30 in the morning. But I got to be drinking. And once I start again, you know, that's the only decision there is. And I go on a 9-month death march into here, where all the yets happened, everything. You know, I had 3 drunk drivings in 5 weeks, and just started taking the train, and just burned everybody and everything in my life to the ground. A lot of funny stuff, but, you know, what I remember more than anything is I remember seeing the exact same look in my father's eyes that I'd seen him looking at my mom 30 years earlier. And eventually, after burning everybody in Portland out, going up there, I came back down just to die. You know, it was kind of like leaving Las Vegas without the fun. So I end up in this flea bag hotel in Santa Cruz during when I could get there. You know, I spent a lot of nights at the end outdoors. And my end came, I'm in this hotel room, and it occurs to me that every reason why I justified and rationalized my drinking for the prior 20 years and certainly the prior 10 years wasn't there anymore. As a matter of fact, they didn't even care at that point. I'm sure they were dreading the phone call, but they really didn't even care. It was just me. At that moment, there was a half gallon of rot gut vodka between pop-off Blue Label. I don't know if you consider it rot gut. So if you don't end up on vodka, you got here too soon. And that was, I don't ascribe to that, but it helps. So I've got a half gallon of vodka between my legs. And at that particular moment, I'm crying at this Love Boat rerun. And I kind of have this out-of-body experience of, this is just pathetic. And I'm somewhere between atheist and agnostic at the point, but I had this vision of drifting off into eternity in this state. And a set of circumstances arose. I hadn't seen my kids in a couple months, and I had to see them in a day. And the truth is, if I could have drugged my liver the half block down to the liquor store one more morning, I would have, and didn't. I was on a train to go see divorce attorneys about 3 days later. It's real foggy in there. And I knew if I got off that train in Salinas, I was going to drink. I knew it, and I just stayed on the train. I was going to get off at San Luis Obispo, and that didn't feel right, and the next stop was Santa Barbara. And got off the train at Santa Barbara and walked up State Street and checked into the Schooner Inn, right across the street from Joe's on State and Coda, $315 a month, and that's where I spent my first year of my sobriety. And when I checked in there, I didn't realize that it was a block and a half from Fellowship Hall up on State Street, and I didn't realize the Alano Club was two blocks down Coda on Coda and Garden. But that's the kind of magical stuff that happens if my head isn't stuck you know where and I'm just awake for it. My sobriety date is October 4th, 1984. Seemed like everybody smoked pot at Fellowship Hall in 1984. I didn't have to drink again, but I did that for 3 or 4 weeks. If you're here tonight on pot, I can tell you my experience was it's really hard to get the program if you're stoned. And the other thing, and the more important thing really, is the meeting isn't nearly as long as it seems. It's really a long hour when you're stoned, you know. I didn't sleep for the first year of sobriety, if that gives the new guy any hope. I don't know if they hadn't discovered Seroquel or whatever they're giving them these days in treatment or what, but I wasn't a hot chick or a guy with a trust fund at that point. So, you know, they told me stuff like, you know, lack of sleep never killed anybody, Scherzer, and a lot of sit down and shut up. But I read the book a lot. I did, and some people took care of me, and some people loved me. My experience, and I'm a big proponent of sponsorship. Sponsors have helped me tremendously. I sponsor 25 guys today. But I think, you know, my experience, I think it kind of saved my ass that I didn't get a sponsor in the first 15 minutes. Because I really believe I was constitutionally incapable of telling anybody the truth. I'm not trying to get somebody's approval one more time. And I really learned AA at a Caro's restaurant they used to drag me to after the meetings. I really didn't understand what you guys were talking about in these meetings. The surrender and, you know, acceptance. It was just blah, 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 blah. But I read that book, you know, cover to cover. It was the only thing that would put me to sleep, kind of, or allow me to pass out. And I read it. And what I read in the book was find God or die. More bad news. You know, anything but that. But I accepted that. I don't read it the same way today. I think there's a difference between finding God and finding God's power in your life. But I had to become open-minded about that, and that all that was required was a willingness to believe. And who was I? You know, it apparently was working for you guys. I was absolutely convinced. I was way too, you know, smart, complicated, complex, deep, tortured, whatever. But I was open to it. And AA really changed for me more than anything, this deep, complicated, complex, too smart for you guys guy. When a guy, Billy Bedard, worked a con on me. He'd worked the con before, and he's still working the same con today. And he grabbed me after a meeting at about 60 days and asked him if I'd do him a favor and take over the coffee thing. Because you guys were such knuckleheads that you were burning the coffee pots out. And he made it sound, I mean, what I heard was, if I didn't do Billy this favor, and Billy really needed AA, if I didn't do Billy this favor, that not only was the Sundowners group of Alcoholics Anonymous not going to make it, but probably all of AA was going to implode. I mean, that's the only way I could have gotten involved. And it really, I mean, it truly saved my life. I didn't find out until I was 20 years sober that Billy really worked the con on Santa Barbara. You know, Billy hit Santa Barbara at 5 years sober, about 6 months before I got there. And he was told not to become, you know, try to find the biggest, slickest, most she, you know, uber hip group, but to get people involved. And he started that 5:30 because he figured he could have 5 secretaries and 5 setups and 5 cleanups and 5 guys he could work the con on with a coffee commitment and 5 treasurers. And so he got a lot of people involved. And there are people that got sober in that group that are still sober today that, you know, the closest people in the world to me. I started working the steps just because, you know, everybody else seemed to be doing them. And in my experience, this is just my experience, I didn't get a lot out of the steps, at least until amends. You know, I mean, I didn't really understand the steps until I started taking other people through them, to be honest with you. There wasn't any kind of magic, and the heavens didn't open when I got to the fourth column and saw my part. You know, I knew what my part was. Nor did I feel like I was walking through archways to a new life hand in hand with God after doing my fifth step. I felt like I needed to get back to the schooner and take a shower because I didn't feel real good about this whole thing. But that next day, I felt more part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've kind of come to believe that, you know, the steps aren't an event you take, or nor do I take them over and over and over myself so that I can get, you know, slicker or whatever. You know, they're really a process. It's something I download and have downloaded. It's like downloading a software program for me. It's nothing we came up with. That's, you know, the idea of admission, surrender, self-survey, confession, restitution, and service are as old as mankind. It's pretty universal. But with a loaded gun of alcoholism in my head, downloading those, they've kind of become part of who and what I am. So that any time I'm in discomfort or dis-ease, I know it's some manifestation of self. You know, I have the thing of what is it and what's it affecting, what's my part in it, what defect. Mine happened to almost always be sloth, greed, and pride. Fortunately, lust is kind of starting to dissipate with old age, all of that, where there's always a lust overlay, you know. And this self thing, that it's... I hear a lot of people say that I'm a completely different person than I was 24 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever. And people would say that about me, but I'm pretty much exactly the same guy that came in here. It's just I act differently. And a lot of this human stuff, this idealized mythology I have about myself and created the too smart, too slick, too tortured, too whatever, has been very much disempowered. Everybody comes in here with an act. I don't know what your act is, you know, tortured boy, dumb guy, bitch and chick, surfer dude, prison guy, tortured girl, you know, we've all got one, we're slaves to them, and it ends up killing us, that self thing. I'm also a big believer, again, just my opinion, that selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our problem. But I'm absolutely convinced that we're no more selfish and self-centered than the other 94% of the population. The difference is it's going to kill you and me, and it doesn't seem to bother them out there at all. You know, that's like we have a perception problem. I don't think we've got a perception. The problem is we're blessed with seeing, perceiving just a little too acutely of how poorly they're doing out there, and the unfairness and the injustice, and how can people act that way, and it's that kind of stuff that my disease very much uses to its benefit and ends up killing me, because this self thing is the thing that separates me from this realm of the spirit. Spirits I found in those first three Blitz Weinhardt stubbies. I have a desperate need to access that realm of the spirit. I think we're people who always have. We're blessed with that. I really believe the condition is a blessing. First song I ever related to in Alcoholics Anonymous was Keith Drum talking about we're twangers. You know, we're kids that sat in the third grade and twanged our rulers. You know, that vibey, and then they got them going. Kids that stared into deep space, you know, when you're 9 years old and wondered what it's all about. And, that desperate need to access this God thing, not for salvation, because it's part of who and what we are. And my truth about this whole journey for the higher power thing, just mine, has been that the problem was never not enough God. The problem was always too much Steve. And as the steps and the process of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has dissipated Steve in my little act, the God thing just is. It isn't a big deal. You know, it was going to be an affront to my entire value system to buy into this bullshit. And I'm just, you know, I'm blessed with being just too tired when I got here to tell you what bullshit this thing all was. And it's why I think most of us, you know, I mean, the good news is if you're new, if you just do what we do, you will recover. The bad news is it doesn't make any sense until you start doing it. And the worst news, for especially as people are getting younger and younger getting sober, is most people recover from drugs and alcohol before they start recovering from the alcoholism. So at 90 days or 4 or 6 months, someone pisses you off and this whole thing seems like an overreaction. Well, you know, and I can stay sober anyway. Screw it, I'm out of here. I don't think anybody goes out again expecting different results. I think most people, it's been my experience, know exactly what's going to happen. I think if there's any delusion, it's that I can go out tonight and come back Monday. You know, because once I drink, then the game's off again. That first step is truly that, you know, Steve's screwed. I got a body that can no longer put one in it without it completely controlling and ruling my life for it. Maybe it's a weekend, maybe it's 6 months, maybe it's 6 years at my stage. I truly believe that if I have another drink, you'll never see me again. And the lucky ones die. We come in, we cry about you, we buy you a brick to put on the wall, and everybody forgets about you in 2 or 3 days. You know, the real alcoholics go out and they do what Bill Wilson said at the end of his story, we perish. You spend 5 or 10 years out there while your soul rots, knowing there's a solution in here, but you can't get back. You can't get that window that I got back in September of 1984. where the planets lined up and the cosmic tumblers and the train stopped at the right place, and I ended up, you know, a block and a half from Fellowship Hall and two blocks from Garden. It's that window that's the blessing. It's the, I think it's the window that gives us. It never seems like a blessing. You know, it seems like the nadir of your life. It's one more time. You know, my head's opinion of the way it's going is always 99% of my problem. AA, if nothing else, has taught me to trust that this is good despite this opinion. I mean, that's really the third step to me. If I've taken a third step, I have to embrace the idea that I'm perfectly on schedule, I've had a perfect life, things are exactly the way they're supposed to be, and I've lost the right to have a negative, shitty opinion about what I'm getting. The stuff that I, in my, both before, but certainly since I've been sober, the stuff that seems the grimmest to me has been the stuff that's given my life the most meaning, the most texture, been the most important stuff for me. I was blessed with being essentially unemployed and unemployable. I was started to go back with shock that no one was particularly excited about me and my act, and ended up managing the Alano Club for another year. They asked me to do it for a month or two in Santa Barbara, and I kind of owed my life to that place, and it ended up being a great deal for me. I did it, lived in there for about a year. My kids were 6 and 8 at the time, and they got to kind of see the inside of what AA is about. I was absolutely certain I was going to get both of them, by the way. My daughter didn't want to be the next president of the Pebble Beach Junior League, and you know, she made a big stink when she was 13 or 14 and wanted to come, and her mom was just, you know, it would really look bad to have her daughter, this little pride, come and live with her alcoholic father in Southern California. But she left it to her, I forget what it's called, it's a high school Christian group, Young Life or one of those things, left it to her counselor she was close with, and went through the kind of the whole story about why she wanted to come down here. And the last, and my daughter's relating to this to me on the phone, and she said, yeah, and then she asked if you believed in God, and I said, what did you say? And my daughter said, oh yeah, my dad's in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's all they ever talk about. And I'm thinking, I'm fucked. And and she said, the gal said, you know, she was a professional counselor too, she says, you know, Betsy, I don't talk about this much, but I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 15 years, and I think your dad's exactly where you should be. So my 14-year-old daughter packed up her bong and her birth control pills and moved in with Dad. I was back practicing by then, and I was with the same firm for 20 years. And both my kids, I was sure they went through the whole drugs and alcohol and all that stuff. And I they're incredibly honest with me. You know, my position about that is it's not a bad thing for you. You just have genetic predisposition to be way, way too good a thing for it, to be nitroglycerin. But they did their deal, and they partied at my house. And I'm a big believer that just as the disease is transmitted through families, not just genetics, it's always an interesting statistic to me that, you know, if one of your parents or both are alcoholic, you got a 45% chance and not a 6%. But if you were raised or adopted in an alcoholic family, your chances are 40%. It's almost as high. There's something transmitted, you know, vibe spiritually. And I've become a big believer that just as the disease is transmitted through families, recovery is too. Those kids are, my son will be 33 in this month, and my daughter's 30 and going to get married to a wonderful guy. And God, I don't know how they came out of it. My son, I still think I'll get, but he doesn't have any problems with it. I mean, he knows. Neither one of them done any drugs and 15 or 10 years or so. Sam doesn't drink, well, can I have a beer or two? It's fine. And then every week or two, you know, it's game on. He has the thing set up, and when you hit, he hits about five beers, it's like lock up the midgets. It's turned on a switch, and psychic change takes place. And it's, but he, you know, he somehow he manages and controls it. So I have a wonderful life. I just retired right before the market crashed. So I've been retired a couple of years now almost, and spent some time in Europe and back east that I'd never done, and really kind of an amazing life. But the truth is, you know, I had an amazing life before, and it doesn't resolve my alcoholism. Time, you know, having a 24-year chip doesn't resolve my alcoholism, or a 10-year chip. What resolves it is my connection to this deal. You know, if you're new, I still have a head that does that, by the way. That my head's still locked into the lotto mentality that I have to smile at, that there's the right woman and address to be living and bank account balance and career and car, that's what is going to really fix you, or, you know, that I'm able to smile at, and that's been pretty disempowered. But, you know, that's being human. My spirit's been encased in this human packaging but I'm not sure I entirely turn my entire life and will over the care of God every morning. I say those words, and I kind of try to act that way when I go out the door, but, you know, I think I'm at least engaged in a power sharing arrangement with him at this point in time. You know, my ego's not, you know, I'm not designed to be in power sharing arrangements. So if you're new and you're, you know, you're at the fuck house or wherever you're going, riding your bicycle to five meetings a week, and you just know that this is just the grimmest thing ever, and what I need to get him back and my car down here somehow, and, you know, and a career and an education, you're going to have all that stuff. We're people of unlimited potential, you know. Smartest people I've ever known are in these rooms. But don't miss this. You know, because the good news is you're going to get all that stuff, and the bad news is it doesn't fix you. What fixes you is this connection that I have experienced through my relationship with the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and particularly through the fellowship of the Alcoholics Anonymous and people in rooms like this. And that once you get your house on the hill and him or her, you're probably going to look back on this first year of sobriety of riding your bike from the hook house, you know, as the best year of your life of just doing this. So, you know, you may be peaking right now. This may be, this, you know, that's the spiritual lesson of Alcoholics Anonymous. This may be as good as it ever gets right now. And you got a loaded gun of alcoholism to your head, which is essentially, you better start enjoying this thing, or because booze still works. Alcohol resolves my alcoholism, but not as consistently and not as perfectly as Alcoholics Anonymous. So thanks again for asking me down here, and God bless you all. Thanks.